Blog Talk Radio.
The following broadcast is brought to you by the iGolf Sports Network.
Golf Talk Live is sponsored by the iGolf Sports Network and Golf Tips Magazine. Here's Andrew to tell you more about our sponsors.
iGolf Sports is a live stream broadcast and media production company providing quality programming designed to attract the golfing enthusiast. And Golf Tips, the game's most in-depth instruction magazine, including reviews on the latest equipment, tips from top teaching professionals, all designed to help you improve from tee to green. Welcome to Golf Talk Live with your host, Ted Odorico. Join Ted each week as he speaks with some of the best in golf. This week's special guest will join us a bit later. But first up is another great discussion on Coach's Corner. So let's introduce tonight's Coach's Corner panel.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Once again, welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Odorico, and we've got a great show for you this evening. Going to be joined here in just a moment by a couple of great professionals joining me on the Coach's Corner panel for an interesting discussion this evening. And then a little bit later on, I'm going to be joined by my very special guest. He's going to be coming back. He was here last year, Dick Zokol, founder and developer of Mindtrack and also a PGA touring professional. He's retired now, but played over 21 years professionally on the tours. And he's going to be joining me to talk a little bit about, we're going to get an update on Mindtrack Golf, an app that was developed by Richard and his team. And then we're also going to talk about, as two fellow Canadians, we're going to talk a little bit about the Canadian Open, which, of course, was canceled again this year. It was supposed to be in early June. We're going to talk a little bit about that, a little bit about the history of it, his experience at the Open, and how things are moving forward and progressing with that particular event. We'll see what's going to happen in years to come. But anyways, glad that you guys could join me, and I'm going to introduce the guys here, and we'll get into tonight's discussion. First up, of course, is Pete Buchanan. He is the founder and director of instruction and owner of Plain Simple Golf LLC, which, of course, houses the Plain Simple Golf Circuit and the Simple Swing Repeater Training Brace. He's also been helping golfers focus on building a repeatable swing for over 30 years now. He's been a good member in standing, if you will, in the golf profession. Also, John Hughes, a PGA Master Professional and honorary president of the North Florida's PGA section. He's also a recipient of the 2013 PGA of America's Horton Smith Award, and he is one of the senior editors and a Golf Tips Magazine Top 25 instructor for Golf Tips Magazine and part of the Golf Tips advisory staff. So, guys, welcome once again to Coach's Corner.
Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Ted.
All right, just to quickly finish what we were talking about, I was sort of going down memory lane, if you will, about how long it's been that you guys have been on the show as regular contributors to the Coach's Corner. And I think Golf Talk Live, of course, we're in the ninth season now, but Coach's Corner didn't start the beginning. It was a year later, so that would go about eight seasons. You guys are on every pretty much every second Tuesday of the month. So quick math, guys, how many times do you think you've been on, not including guest appearances?
I would say enough for Pete to keep me out of trouble.
Right.
There we go.
Well,
it's a lot.
I'm doing a simple math. So at least 10 times a year times eight. So we're looking at least 80 plus times that you guys have been on here on the Coach's Corner panel over the years, give or take a few here and there. So that's been a long time that you guys have been joining on the show, and I appreciate all of your input, of course. All right, we're going to talk about, guys, and Pete, I'm going to start with you if you don't mind. We're going to talk about some tips to help junior golfers to make it a little bit more fun and exciting for the youngsters. And I think one of the first things is, Pete, is obviously we want to connect them. First off, we want to find out what their level of interest is. And again, you know, obviously the younger they are, we're going to do things that are a little more age appropriate. But certainly at some point, if they've expressed an interest, we want to get them off to a good start. So I think it's a good idea to maybe hook them up with a golf professional in their particular area, of course. And I think it's important to do that. Maybe you can touch on a few reasons why it's good to get them involved with a professional of some sort, whether it be an LPGA or PGA or other, early on. Maybe you could talk a little bit about why that's important, I think, to get them started off right.
Well, first of all, again, thanks, Ted, for having me on. John, looking forward to it. You know, as the juniors progress, you know, I get a lot of questions, you know, when I'm out at the range, and they'll have some kids that are, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, and they're asking me, you know, when should we start them on lessons? You know, and my first response is, well, let's make sure they're interested in it first. Just let them have some fun. Give them, make sure that you get some equipment that fits, which, you know, nowadays is, you know, there's all kinds of junior sets out there that they can get clubs that fit them. And you know, we didn't have that back when I started. You know, you got, they were either too long or you cut them down and they were too stiff, or however you got your club set up. But, you know, get them something that fits. And, you know, at the beginning for the younger ones, let them have some fun. And as you said, when they start to show interest, yeah, definitely then, you know, get them some help so they can build a solid foundation. And that's really what it's all about. You know, learning how to grip it, how to aim, how to stand, you know, the basic motions and movements that are involved in, you know, learning how to get those fundamentals down early on. And, you know, that will then spur them to, you know, becoming even better than they are now, and continue their interest along with, you know, moving them in a direction of continuing to play, whether they decide to keep it on a casual basis or, you know, they want to play junior golf, high school golf, college golf. So there's, you know, definitely have to start them off with a solid foundation. Getting a professional teacher in there to help them with that is something that's pretty critical at the beginning. So I always encourage them, you know, once they show an interest, you know, get them started. And, you know, for me on a personal level, you know, I try to keep it pretty simple when they start off. You don't want to get too complicated as you're starting to introduce them, but you do want to get the basic fundamentals down. That's the solid piece that they need to have, and that structure that's going to be there, and getting them to understand, you know, all the points of it. I don't spend a lot of time at the beginning, you know, just on the full swing. I get them over to putting and chipping and pitching. I want them to understand that there's shots that are necessary to score, and, you know, there's different parts to the game, and they need to understand all of it. And, you know, and have some fun along the way. I try to set up some games for them when we're practicing, and, you know, not just, you know, putting from one spot to the other, or, you know, have a little contest with them, or put some obstacles in their way and get them to think a little bit. But, you know, just to try to make it more fun as they're going along. But I think definitely, you know, once they begin to show an interest, getting them some professional teaching help is vital for them to, you know, get the fundamentals down in their progression as they become, you know, more experienced golfers, and, you know, help to lead them in a direction that they want to go. And there are some that go the other way. They show some interest, and then they go along, and then they get to 14, 15, and other sports come in, and they're gone. But you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
That happens too. So, but I think once they begin to show that they want to play, yeah, getting them some professional help, professional teacher, professional golfers, PGA, LPGA, whoever's there available, is definitely a sound thing for them to do to get started.
Yeah, and great points. And I think you're exactly right. I think it's, again, you have to look at the age, number one, and there's sort of a natural progression. Firstly, you want to find out if there's any interest whatsoever or attraction to the game. And maybe their parents play golf, John, or something there that they've been exposed to it somehow. And now they've maybe expressed an interest in wanting to have a little bit better understanding of the game. And I think it's important to have that early introduction with a golf professional. One thing I do want to ask you, John, is I'm going to ask you a different question because I think Pete pretty much covered that. But I think typically, and you may or may not agree with this, I think early on when you do get them into starting to take some instruction, is it better to start them off in more of a group environment, like group instruction? Does that work best initially? And then as they progress and they take a more definitive interest, then sort of wean them off into more specialized one-on-one instruction. What are your thoughts here as far as when's it appropriate for group instruction and when's it appropriate for a one-on-one format?
Great question, Pete. Great answer to the last question. Appreciate Ted, you having us both on the program. Looking forward to a lot of fun with Pete, as always. Group or individual has a lot to do with the individual. There are kids that don't function very well in a group. They need individual. There are kids that thrive in the group, and that's where they start. It's a lot of discussion back and forth with parents to figure out which is the best environment for that youngster to start the game. I think the majority of them do have more fun in a group, especially when the group is centered around what's called gamification, making the instruction more game-like. It's more engaging. It's more interactive. And it's a lot more fun, and it's a lot less about the academia and the mechanics and the preciseness. It's more about, hey, can you do this? You think you can do this? Show me you can do this. And giving the child a challenge, and then if they fail or succeed, either way, you've got them in your pocket from an instruction standpoint of view. If they succeed, you know you can reinforce the skill. If they're failing, you know that there's a teachable opportunity, but how deep of the teaching you want to get into with the group, that's all up to the individuals of the group. At the end of the day, I think we all, even as adults, like learning things new in a group. Mm-hmm. It helps our transformational learning process. We share it. We bond with that. We can share similar stories, as well as we're able to sort of struggle along, really take a nice bath of clean water. When someone succeeds, we all feel part of it. And when someone's in the dirty water, we help them out of it. It's a very simple concept, the group situation, but again, addressing the individual. Maybe the child's autistic. Maybe the child mm-hmm. has a learning disability. Maybe the child's got such a schedule, they can't fit into a group. That's a little bit different case scenario. That's a totally different subject topic all in itself. But when that youngster needs to have the individual instruction, I think the same philosophy, parents, you should take with that. Find an instructor who's going to make the instruction fun. It's not about the X's and O's. It's about creating a self-challenging situation where the child can show themselves what they're capable of doing, can ask questions in an environment they feel comfortable in, feel secure in. Some kids feel that way with individual, but when you can share that comfortability amongst other people, especially at a young age, you seem to keep people involved, and that's really the bottom line. Let's not get any young man or woman of any age, it doesn't matter, in a situation where they no longer want to participate. That's a lot to do with the parent-child communicating and then communicating with the instructor as to which setting's best for them.
Right. Great points, John. Thank you. Pete, I think the other thing, too, that we need to be mindful of is, especially with younger kids, you know, as they progress and get into their teens and particularly their late teens, you know, I think this can apply for everybody, but for younger kids in particular, they need variety. Certainly you're never too young to learn, but some of our smallest swingers need a mixture of activities to keep clinics and lessons fresh and exciting. You know, really any activity that emphasizes hand-eye coordination, balance, or athletic movement certainly is good for golfers' early development, but may not necessarily be something that you want to start a youngster off with. But that variety is important, right, P?
No question. I think more than anything else, you're trying to make it, as John said, as enjoyable, make it fun, but you're also trying to give them within the same skill a different variety of things they can do to develop that skill. You know, we try to take, especially the short game, and give them, you know, different scenarios or give them different different things to do where we'll put, you know, an obstacle up, sort of like a high jump bar, and that we can adjust and say, I want you to hit it under it, I want you to hit it over it, you know, and without really giving them the technique or the mechanics of it, just say, hey, can you do it? Just like John said, hit it underneath this, hit it over it, You know, what club would you need to do this? And sort of start to get their imagination working a little bit while having some fun and hitting some different types of shots while they're doing it. Or, you know, just looking at the range and there's a 50-yard sign. How many of you can hit it? What would you think? See if you can hit that sign. You know, what club would you need to use to do it? You know, what type of shot would you need to hit to hit it? The sign's only about 4 feet off the ground, so what are you going to have to do? Do you want to come in from high? Do you want to go low? And so I think in all the different areas, you know, you have your basic putting, chipping, pitching, you know, but I think in all of those different setups, the more ways you can work around the skill set and give them different options to develop that skill, I think the more interest they're going to stay in it, the more fun they're going to have, and I think that's going to continue them to continue on and create golfers out of them for the rest of their lives. So, yeah, there's no question. You have to have a variety of things for them to do. I know for the little ones, we have some programs that we do, and many times they don't even have a club or a golf ball around them. We're doing all kinds of fun activities that, you know, have some motions that are similar to what golf is going to do, but we're doing something else. Just to have something different, have something fun and something they're more familiar with. All the young ones, you know, what other sports do you play? And then try to incorporate some of those pieces of the other sports they play into what we're trying to do with our stuff, just to give them some familiarity with, you know, other things that they're used to doing and, you know, using those skills to help their golf skills. So definitely want a variety of things that they're trying to do.
Well, I think that all well said. I think that old saying, variety is the spice of life, I think is never more true than in a situation like this. Thank you again, Pete, for some great points raised. John, I think, you know, another old saying is don't sweat the details. Obviously, as Pete pointed out earlier, you know, solid fundamentals are important. But it's fine, I think, for a beginner to have a few flaws in their grip or stance as long as they are hitting the ball and having fun and obviously wanting to return to the course. But there's also a time, too, I think, would you agree, that we want to kind of turn the pupil into a teacher and having them ask questions about why maybe a change might be necessary in their swing. What do you think about that?
Well, one of the coaching styles I adapted early on was trying to have my clients become their own best coach by asking them insightful, introspective questions. And there was something mentioned earlier, Pete, sort of when we were talking about when should a child take lessons. One of the answers I provide parents is when they're asking questions that you can't answer. And that's the beginning of that process. When any child's asking questions about something they're passionate about and a parent's not able to provide those answers, it's time to get instruction. It's time to provide lessons and tutoring and mentoring to that youngster to fuel the passion. From the standpoint of view of providing instruction versus having the client, regardless of the age, provide their own instruction. Really good coaches are going to always ask provocative questions. What did you feel? What do you think of what you did there? Can you tell me where the face of the golf club was at impact? Three very simple questions that make any youngster be self-reflective. What did I do there? What did I feel there? If I did this and did that, where was the face? Anytime you can get a child thinking that way cognitively, you've got them in the right space. You've got them in the right frame of mind for retained learning. And that's always something that I know I'm seeking out. Pete and I have had this discussion in the past off the program, and I know he does the same thing. We can't be there all the time. And for someone to play golf and continually turn around and ask somebody, well, what do I do next? What do I do next? How do I do this? How do I do that? That's not a great lesson you're taking if that's what you're coming out with. What you should be coming out with is some confidence and understanding and knowing what to do next. But where this comes from is learning from the mistakes, asking questions retrospectively and introspectively of, hey, what did I just do? And how can I correct this the next time I attempt it? And that's really what I think a great coach is after and what a parent should be after when it comes to their child developing and continuing to have the passion for their golf skills.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And Pete, I think, you know, something else that we have to be mindful of as professionals in golf, and that is we certainly want our students, especially our young students, to spend some quality time practicing, whether it be chipping or bunker play, and you know, working out on the range, if you will, some of the areas that they need the most work on. But it's also equally important to make to get them out in the golf course and certainly as soon as possible, rather than spending all of their time just banging balls at the range. We want them on the range, of course, doing certain things, but we want to get them on the golf course as quickly as possible. Maybe you can explain a little bit more why we want to do that.
Well, there's definitely, you know, in anything that you do, the more you practice, the better you're going to get at it. So you're going to have to spend some practice time. I have a spreadsheet that I developed, which gives, you know, the kids certain tasks for each one of the areas from, you know, the full swing on into the short game, the days of the week that they perform those tasks and the amount of time they spend doing them. And that way they have a schedule of practice. So then I know they're out there doing it. And these are the ones that are a little bit more advanced. But, you know, again, you're going to want the youngsters, you're going to want them to understand that practice is part of the process. And so you're going to have to get out there and hit some balls. And, you know, I always like to tell them, too, I said, if you want to get the most value out of the bucket of balls you bought, then go over where the short game area is. You can pick those up all day long. You can hit those for a long time, you know, versus the ones you hit out on the range, and then when they're gone, you got to go get some more. So if you really want to look at some very valuable practice time, you know, use that to your advantage. Take those balls over there and hit them up on the green. Go, you know, go fetch them, bring them back, and do some more. But there's definitely a piece of where you have to practice on the range to develop those skills that you're going to need when you go play. But also wanted to get them to understand, you know, when you have an opportunity to play, you know, make sure you get out there and do that. Get on the golf course and play and start to learn on the golf course, you know, what you're good at, what you're not so good at, where you, you know, excel in areas of the game and where you don't. And then let's use that to our advantage. So when we go back to the practice time, let's take those areas that you're not very good at and let's incorporate them into that practice schedule that we have so we can advance those skills and while still maintaining the other ones, but then start to get you better at the things that, you know, that give you a little bit of difficulty so that way we can have a well-rounded game all the way around. I mean, there's always going to be probably a point in everybody's game where they're better at a certain thing. They're a really good putter, not as good a chipper. You know, you're going to have areas that you fall down a little bit on, but those are the ones then that you have to be, you know, conscious of that you need to practice. So I think if we can instill them getting to the range and putting those skills to test and practicing those and you know, again, in some of the things that I have them do, it's not only just practicing chipping, but we have certain things that we're going to do in that create some imagination and have them hit little different shots. I mean, sometimes I'll put them, you know, 5 feet off the green and I said, okay, today you have to do all those with the iron you have. And they'll all look at me like, what? I'm only 5 feet off the green. I said, yeah, I know. And that pin's only 5 feet on the green. So now how are you going to do this? You got to figure it out.
Yep.
So it creates some, you know, different imagination, different things that they can do. You know, and as you said, working on touch and feel, which is going to be, you know, and I think the hardest part about golf overall is all of the scoring shots, you know, are touch and feel. You got to have some feel, and those require more practice. So I try to instill in them early on that they got to get out there and practice those.
Yeah, I think it's a balancing a balancing act for golfers of any age, really. I mean, you have to. There's definitely some range time that includes obviously the practice greens as well. But you know, you have to find balance in what you do. But ultimately, you're there to play the game. And if you're not getting out in the golf course, if all you're doing is spending the majority of your time on the driving range, or you know, in the practice area, and you're not actually getting out and playing, you're not practicing some of those things, using some of that imagination that you're talking about, and putting together a good round. And you're just hitting balls. And if you want to be a range rat, as they say, then that's fine. If that's what you enjoy doing, and you're not really, you know, a big player, if you will, not really all that keen about it, then that's fine too. And John, that brings me to this next point, which is our sixth point here, and that is really, it's up to the child to decide. After all, it's their journey. And maybe not all junior golfers, as I was starting to allude to, maybe want to play in tournaments. Some maybe just like getting out there and, you know, hitting some, sharing a few good shots and having a few laughs with their friends. That's okay, isn't it?
Absolutely. In one word, absolutely. It is all about fun. I can't say how many. I've probably said it 80 times if I've been on this show 80 times. It is about fun. The issue that you bring up as far as it's the child's choice, I think it's clouded quite often by parents who see talent. They see raw ability. They see athleticism. And really, in the best of hearts and mind, want the child to experience success, whether they've experienced it or not. I don't believe too heavily in living vicariously through. I think at some point the parent gets real about that. But I think all parents want their child to have an opportunity to succeed. What a parent fails to see is the loss of passion for whatever that loss of passion is. So it does become the child's decision. And what we have to keep in mind, it's not a legal decision. It's not like you can go to court at 12 years old and choose what parent you're going to live with in some states. It's more or less, hey, this is what I want to do, and here's why I want to do it. And I think if the parents are listening to the why, then they'll understand how their child lost the passion. Maybe they're wanting to do something else because why? And I kept that in mind. I've got a 19-year-old, and he's the best example I can give within this question. He was brought up in a golfing family. He was surrounded by great golfers, celebrity golfers, for most of his life. And at 12 years old, he decided, I want to play competitive golf. And to his astonishment, I looked him square in the eye. I said, okay, no problem. Realize I didn't ask you to do this. You asked to do it, and now you're asking not to do it, and that's okay. What I didn't want him to do is completely burn out and dismiss golf. And what's neat about it, parents, is to this day at 19 years old, I just spent part of a weekend with them, and part of that weekend was playing nine holes. Not because I asked him, but because he asked me. When you create a healthy environment around your child that allows them to pick and choose what they're wanting to do because of their passion, and that's the main reason why. If they lose some of the passion competitively, that's okay. Just at least keep them involved in something they're passionate about, particularly golf, because it's something they can go back to time after time after time, as well as have something in common with a lot of other folks on the planet that may not have had that opportunity. It fosters a lot of goodwill and networking, but at the same time, that introspection I was talking about before is what my son says why he wants to go play golf with me, because not only do we get the chance to share time with one another, he gets to start thinking about himself a little bit deeper in different ways that actually helps him out with the daily things that he experiences, and I can't say enough about that.
Yep. You know, it's interesting that you say that. It's such a true statement, really, for parents not to rush. You know, obviously if the child comes to you and expresses an interest in the game for whatever reason, you know, then obviously explore that together. But just because you as a parent – maybe grew up playing golf, there's nothing wrong with, you know, introducing your son or daughter to the game. But if they you know, if they at some point express an interest very early on, well, this is maybe not for me, then you have to be willing to let that go. And maybe it may resurface at a later point. But just because you want to make it into a family thing doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be because, you know, I use myself as an example. My sister and I growing up, you know, my father obviously was very passionate about golf at a very, you know, early age himself. And when I was a youngster, he got me into the game. My sister, you know, not so much. She didn't really have the same interest very early on. However, she did take it up later in life. She developed a passion for it then. But, you know, so there were two different children. We each had a different way of looking at it. You know, maybe mine was partially because I was a boy and, you know, a son and father sort of deal. Maybe that was part of it. But, you know, he never pushed either one of us into the game. It was based on what we wanted to do. And I think that's very, very important. And both of you have really kind of raised that. Pete, slumps are part of the sports in general, and particularly in golf, we've seen a few over the years. I don't think that's really anything to be concerned of. If you've got a junior golfer that's maybe playing in some competitive tournaments and so forth, obviously for the younger kids, I mean, they're not really competitive, so it's not going to really be effective. But if they start to get into junior tournaments or collegiate sports, they're going to experience some slumps. What can we do, number one, as teachers to help them navigate that process and understand that? And is there something, a role that the parents can play as well to be encouraging?
Well, yeah, every sport's going to have slumps in it. You can see it all the time from, you know, different, even the professional sports, football, baseball, basketball, there's always going to be a time when things aren't going as well as they should go. And I think more than anything else, it's letting them know that those situations, you know, may come up. And when they do come up, you know, don't lose focus on what we're trying to do. We've just got to learn from this particular spot, understand what's going on, and let's try to combat what's happening there and learn from, you know, why things aren't going as well as they are. And, you know, the things that we can do to make them better. So, you know, there's, you know, it's not always going to be, you know, rose and gold going on when you're playing golf. I mean, there's just so many different things that can happen, so many different golf courses. And I know, you know, I tried to explain to this to one of the juniors. He's got a pretty good game. He's got a shot shape that he likes to play. And there's one particular golf course where all the holes go the other way and he doesn't play well there. I said, you know what, that's going to happen. So we got to figure out a game plan to combat that. You know, he feels like it's, you know, sort of slumpish, but I said, no, it's not. It's just you're playing a golf course that doesn't fit your game. If that happens, I said, I know PGA Tour players, friends of mine, that there are certain golf courses they don't play. They don't fit their game. Mm-hmm. So they don't play them. Put them in their schedule. That's fine. You know, so there's going to be times when things aren't going to go as, you know, according to plan or going as well as you think they will. So, you know, we don't need to lose any sleep over it. We just got to, you know, be aware that there's going to be times when things aren't going along as well as they should. And, you know, you just have to, you know, play through those. Things are going to turn around. They will get better. You know, it's going to happen. You know, you will get through it, and we'll come out on the other side learning from what happened. And, you know, maybe those slumps will be a little bit smaller the next time. But, yeah, it's every sport has it. You know, it's just the way it is. I mean, you know, there's no reason to really look around the other side. We just have to learn from it, understand that they're there, and then, you know, continue on down the road. And you know, hopefully they get smaller as they go. But you know what? You know, there's so many elements that come into it, you know, even from especially in today's day and age. I mean, you know, I was just talking about one of the players that I'm helping coach with at the University of Missouri who's, the last four or five holes, you know, just wasn't playing very well. And I said, well, how's your nutrition? Bingo. There it is. Mm-hmm. You know, running out of juice in the last four or five holes and running out of energy. So I said, well, we need to change that. You know, so it could be something like that too. So there's so many elements that are involved today, you know, so a conversation is good to have to find out what's going on overall and, you know, use everything we can to help them through it, to soften it a little bit as we can and, you know, move forward from there.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, I think one of the other things that we have to, you know, keep mindful of is even a negative experience can be turned into a positive. You know, we're, as you pointed out, Pete, you know, we're all going to experience slumps or, you know, moments where things are not going to go our way. But that's always an opportunity, I believe, to learn. And it's also a great way to develop your mental strength, because if you can ride it through and if you can develop your mental game a little bit more through those slumps or difficult stretches of time, you're going to become a better player. I mean, even the best players in the world, you know, Tiger, Jack, you know, many of the other great players that have come along over the years have all experienced those moments. But it was the ones that were more mentally tough, if you will, for lack of better words, that were able to ride it out. There were others that didn't have that same toughness out in the golf course and ultimately ended up, you know, either giving up or just not, you know, continuing on very well for the following years because they just weren't able to get over it and started making a lot of swing changes, a lot of very aggressive changes in their game in order to overcome it as opposed to just sort of letting it happen. John, I want to switch gears just a little bit. I certainly want to continue to talk about junior golf, but I want to get into a little bit more advanced junior golf as we continue on in this discussion. And, you know, now we're getting up into maybe high school or even as far up as collegiate golfers. Our focus as instructors is going to change. Earlier on, we're obviously, as Pete pointed out at the very beginning, you know, we're dealing more with fundamentals and really understanding the basics of the game. But when they start getting into a team format or into a higher level, now it's not an instructor's hat anymore. It's more of a coaching hat. What do we need to do with junior golfers at this point when we make that switch from teaching pro to maybe a coach? How does our role change and how we deal with that particular individual?
Well, I've been at that particular part of the industry for quite a while, and the biggest role change that I have had to experience for myself is being more than just an instructor. I've talked about this in the past, that the vast majority of people out there are teachers, then you become an instructor, and the very top of the pyramid, less than 2%, 3% by some estimates, is that coach. And the way I describe it is, remember your favorite teacher in school, that person when you saw them at the mall, they said hello and engaged your parents. Or when you saw them somewhere else, just out in the middle of nowhere, they actually asked you about you and not about your schooling. Well, that's what a golf coach emphatically does for their clients. I constantly, as we've been on the show today, I've actually received two texts from junior competitive clients. Let me know how they're doing or they're stuck with something, and I'll answer those texts when we're done. But it's, 7:38 in the evening on the East Coast. My job's never done. So one of the things you look for in a coach is, do they look at it as a job? Teachers and instructors do. Coaches don't look at it as a job. They look at it as a lifestyle, as a way of life, but they're an integral part of the child's development to become that much more competitive. I think that's the biggest thing that I can tell parents about from a junior golfer standpoint of view. Don't be surprised if your coach, again, to reiterate what I said before, as you start becoming your own coach in competitive situations, it's all about the weakest chain metal in your armor. What is the weakest part? And we're going to work hard on that because that's where you'll expose yourself. Unlike other sports where your combatant, the team you're playing against can expose your weaknesses, you expose your own weaknesses. And what a really good competitive junior golf coach does is puts a plan together that I don't talk about it as weaknesses. I talk about it as opportunities. here's an opportunity based on your stats. Here's an opportunity based on how you played your last round of competitive golf that you can improve upon, because that's where you're going to get hit the most in the face by yourself. And those are, that's when you are going to turn around and go, coach, what should I do? You can't do that. You've got to be able to make a split decision, a correct decision, right there and then. And it's just part of the maturation process. You have to realize that as a junior golfer, you have not lived through the experiences that you and I and Pete and countless other coaches have lived through. What we're there to do is help you and guide you based on our mistakes. And we genuinely don't want to see you make the same mistakes. But in some cases, we have to allow you to do that. It's okay to make mistakes. The best players in the world do it countless times throughout a round. What they're able to do is make great decisions after that mistake and realize that it's not about being perfect. And I think that leads me to the final point of this question. A lot of times from a coach's standpoint of view, I see parents and junior golfers and in some cases coaches striving for this mystical place of perfection. I think the work ethic you put into it, the processes, the procedures you put in leading you to that, and Pete sort of hit on this, I'm just saying it a little bit differently, that's perfection in itself. And what your coach should be doing with you is helping you understand that if you do all these things correctly, you will trend in the correct direction. We're not looking for you to spike immediately just simply because a college coach you want to prove something to. A college coach wants to see progression, steady progression, that you haven't reached your peak, that you've got some work ethic to you. You've got a plan that's based on solid fundamental stats. And that plan is holistic. So when you're in the worst of situations, the worst part of your armor doesn't get exposed. And that's really what I've seen me as a coach transform into. This dates back to my IJGA days, 21, 22 plus years ago. That was the biggest metamorphosis I had to make as a coach, and continue to do so, not only for the competitive juniors that I have, which over the past couple of years I've gained quite a few. I take that same look at juniors, whether they're beginners or an adult, that, hey, it's all about seizing an opportunity, understanding what's out there, and allowing you to seize it on your own when the chips are down.
A lot of great points there. Well said, John. Pete, there's another thing that we have to consider, you know, as John talked about, you know, developing a game plan with your student, as we get into more of a coaching mode as opposed to a teaching mode. And, you know, it's not just about putting the plan together, but it's also putting it into practice, getting the student engaged in the plan, getting them to follow that plan. But every once in a while, we get into a situation, Pete, where maybe the plan that we've put together, along with our student, of course, isn't yielding the results that maybe he or she had hoped for, or we would hope for. So my question to you is, once we come to that conclusion and we've maybe tried a few minor tweaks and whatnot here and there, adjustments along the way, it's just not panning out. Do we then revamp and create a new plan? How do we handle that situation?
Wow, that's a great question there. You know, I've always said, you know, the responsibility of the success of what the player does falls on me, because, you know, I'm the one that has to get the message across, has to get the quote-unquote plan in place and make sure it's something that they can do so they're successful. But, you know, there are times when, you know, what you do put together isn't working. And I can tell you, right away, and it's not it's a little bit off of the junior, but I'll just say it's a player. I had taken this particular one. I had a plan of what I wanted to do with the golf swing, and I'll be the first one to admit, I was not getting anywhere. So mm-hmm. I totally revamped the plan. And I just said to him, I said, look, I mean, here's the deal. I said, it's not, you know, 6 o'clock news we're watching to notice that your contact with the golf ball is not what it should be. So I said, mm-hmm. that falls on me. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to change this up a little bit. And I explained to them from a cause and effect standpoint why I'm going this route and what I determined needs to be done. And thankfully enough, it worked right away. So, I got some results, you know, right off the bat. But, you know, that happens. And so, yeah, you got to change the plan. That's just the way it is. I mean, I'll be the first one to admit, even from a professional level. I mean, I put forth the plan with the player. I took this player about as far as I thought, you know, we could take him. And they said, you know, I think I need to go another direction, which is fine. That happens too. Mm. You know, I gave them what I thought they should be doing. And, you know, sometimes the plans work out, sometimes they don't. But you have to be as a coach, as an instructor, as a professional, as a person to have the wherewithal to understand that and also have, you know, the ability to say, hey, look, we put this together. It's not quite the right one. I'll be the first one to admit that. Here's the changes that I propose we make. And you have to be, you know, a big enough person to be able to understand that and take that responsibility. Because I've totally seen it go the other way, where, you know what, you just can't do it, and it's all on you. And that's the wrong approach, because, you know, you can destroy a kid, you know, pretty quickly with that. So I think the responsibility should always fall on the coach. A discussion with the parents is good, too, because I've done that. I said, look, hey, this is the direction I thought we should go. It's not working. Here's the changes I want to make. Let's see where we go from here. And if it doesn't work, you know, maybe we have to go a totally different direction from there. And, you know, maybe it's somebody else you need other than me. So you have to take that responsibility as a coach. You know, you got to be the one to say, hey, you know, we put this plan together, but it didn't work. So now here are the options. You know, and here's what we have to do. So, it's a tough one, but, you know, it does happen.
Yeah, and that's a great really way to approach that question, Pete, because, you know, you're 100% right. Too often we see, and it's not just in golf, we see it in every aspect of life, where, you know, sometimes egos get in the way. It can even be the students. Sometimes a student gets stubborn and thinks, no, I have a better way, and they're not always following the instruction the way they should be, or they're negating certain aspects of the instruction. But I think it does fall back on the coach, John, because I think from a coaching standpoint, sometimes we're going to do what we think is best for that student and going to yield the best results based on our experience. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean we made a wrong decision, but because we are all individuals and different from one another, sometimes the student themselves, through no fault of their own, maybe responds better to different stimuli, if you will, than maybe we originally are putting forth. And sometimes that creative plan needs to be adjusted in some cases or even revamped substantially in order to be successful. And if we've got students who want to progress even beyond, a team format, whether it be collegiate or whatever, we definitely have to be conscious of that. Let me hear your thoughts on that as well. I know I'm sure you agree a lot with what Pete said, but I'm sure you've been faced with situations like that where you've worked with a student for a period of time and things maybe just didn't go down the path that you would hope they are. What are some of the things that you've had to do and come to realize over time, hey, I need to make these changes? What are your thoughts here?
Well, this is a great topic, and it's probably something that Pete and I go through every day as we search and think about all of the different clients we touch, whether competitive or not. How far down the rabbit hole do you really want to go is really mm-hmm. what your question is about. And at what point do you stop going down the rabbit hole, pull yourself out, and start a new one? There's a lot of variables to it. And mm-hmm. one of the first things I learned as a leader was, let's not put blame on anyone else but myself. until I have figured out that, number one, I've given every resource possible to that person. B, I've given every bit of support possible to that person. And C, I've exhausted my entire knowledge base to help that person. And my knowledge base is just not me. It's the library in my office. It's you. It's Pete. Mm-hmm. It's the other people that I know in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I will put that blame on me first and will be the first one to pull the plug, especially if I see someone in discomfort, physical, mental, emotional. It'll show through in a lot of nonverbal first. And that's typically when I'm thinking about it. And I think Pete would agree there's probably been a couple of times where you wake up at night and have this epiphany that if you keep going down the rabbit hole and do this different, then you'll get to the other side. And most of the time, I would give you a coin flip chance that that's going to work. You have
right.
to recognize as a coach, hey, have I done everything humanly possible to help this young man or woman out? Number one, if I answered all those questions I just raised as yes, I'm then going to go down another variable track. And what is that variable track is, what is that junior doing? Are they capable of it physically, emotionally, or mentally of what I'm asking them to do? Do they have the time to do it? Are they getting the support at home to do it? Sometimes grades, sometimes other priorities get in the way. You have to look at it very holistically and eliminate the variables, starting with the coach first. If you're a coach out there listening, please heed to that advice. If you're a parent, ask the coach, have you done everything humanly possible? My son or daughter is this, that, and the other. Before we start changing directions, which I'm willing to do, I trust you, let's make sure that we've done everything that way. It's okay as a coach to admit that you're wrong. I don't think anybody really wants to admit that at any point.
Right.
But there's ways of saying, hey, look, we spent 2 months trying to get this accomplished, and for whatever reason it's not working, I'll take the blame for this. I apologize for you working as hard as you have, regardless of where the blame is pointed. But it's the job of the coach and the parent to sort of stop everything in its tracks, to say, look, we had this type of success before this point in our journey. We need to back up a little bit, do some Socratic learning to that point, and move in a slightly different direction. Maybe it's a slight alteration. Maybe it's a complete and utter 180-degree change. It doesn't matter. Just everybody understanding from the standpoint of view of coach and parent first, because I think what juniors do is they totally believe in their coach at first and go down that road. And if they go down the road and things aren't working, they're of the experience level, the age and experience level of not taking ownership quite fully. And they're looking for somebody or something to blame. And that's where the coach and the parent really have to communicate and let the child know, hey, it was mutual. We did you wrong. But that shouldn't mean that you shouldn't trust us anymore. You shouldn't believe in what we're doing. Here's the track record of the coach, or here's your track record. We just got off the record a little bit at this juncture. Let's go back to this place where you're comfortable and go on from there. And I think if more parents were involved with this and have a true understanding of what the coach is racking our brains over day in, day out at some point, they would get a better understanding of how all in we are with their junior golfer.
Mm-hmm. Great point, John. And, you know, one last thing I just want to add to that is I think – from a coaching standpoint, when you're working with a junior golfer and you're, you know, getting into, and I hate to use the word slump in your approach, sometimes I think it's good and it's honest as a coach to bring in another set of eyes, another professional in to take a look at the situation, because a lot of times when you're entrenched in a program or teaching philosophy, sometimes we get a little bit narrow or our focus gets a little bit narrowed. And sometimes bringing an outside perspective can shed maybe some new light to the situation, and I think that's good as well. And, you know, Pete, as you pointed out, I think, or might have been John that pointed out earlier, about nutrition, there's other factors as well. It may not necessarily be their ball striking. It may not necessarily be other aspects of their game. It might be the fact that they're not nutritionally taking care of themselves and they're losing steam out there, you know, during their round or during their practice session. So making sure that we cover all of those things. But great points, guys. I think you did a fantastic job, as always, here on the Coach's Corner panel. And as always, I'm going to give you guys just a minute or two, if you wouldn't mind, just letting the folks know how they can reach out and get in touch with you guys.
I'll go, Ted.
I'm sorry, Pete, go ahead. Pete, go ahead first, then John.
They can. First of all, thanks again, Ted. It's always great being on the show. And John, yeah, you know, you and I have done this a lot together, and I always enjoy listening to what you have to say. It's always a great time on the show. They can get a hold of me at PeteBuchananGolf.com. All the things that I'm doing are on there. It just makes it simple. Everything's in one spot. And so, you know, very, very simple to get a hold. And I always say, you know, just send me a note and let's start a conversation, because that's the best way to start to get to your golf game. And let's have a discussion and figure out what's going on. And then we can start to work on the game from there. But thanks again, Ted. Really appreciate it.
Always my pleasure. John, go ahead.
Sure, Pete. You kept me out of trouble once again, sir. I'm looking forward to more next month. Ted, always an honor as well. I appreciate the opportunities you provide me. And if anybody's needing to get a hold of me for coaching, it sounds like I was sort of a counselor this evening as well. I can freelance with that. John Hughes Golf, that's all you need to remember, whether it's a website, a social media channel. I do want to remind people that you can receive my coaching virtually through Instant Golf Improvement, which is a virtual portal I set up a couple of years ago. It's a great opportunity to get some great coaching, view a lot of great video content within a library, and looking to expand that as we go. Again, thanks, Ted. Thanks, Pete. And I hope everybody has a great weekend.
All right. Sounds good. All right, guys, have a great one, and I will see you next time here on the Coach's Corner panel on Golf Talk Live. Have a good weekend, guys.
All right. You too.
Thanks, Ted.
All right. We're going to take a quick message break, and then we'll be back with this evening's special guest.
This edition of Golf Talk Live is brought to you by Golf Pal, the best place to find only the finest in golf training aids and accessories. Get in on some great deals on leading products such as Down Under Board, Rough Soto, Golf Slingshot, and more. Visit golfpal.golf today. And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. Golf Pal. We're serious about your game.
The following ad is sponsored by Golf Tips Magazine.
Are you tired of being short off the tee? And what about those three putts? Forget about it. It's time you got serious about your game. Golf Tips, the most in-depth magazine in the industry. For over 30 years, Golf Tips has delivered expert content such as the latest golf instruction from America's top pros, simple-to-follow practice and game improvement drills, fitness and mental game tips, equipment, training aids, accessory and apparel reviews, golf destinations and travel tips for every budget, and so much more. Don't miss a single issue. Go to golftipsmag.com and subscribe today.
All right. Very excited to have this evening's guest join me once again. He is the founder and developer of MindTrack Golf. He was also a PGA touring professional, now retired. For 21 years he's been on the tour. Has developed an incredible system. We talked about it a few months back about MindTrack Golf. We're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later on, but we're going to talk about a few other things as well. Of course, I'm talking about my very special guest and fellow Canadian, Richard Zocco. Please welcome my very special guest. Good evening, Richard. Welcome.
Thank you, Ted. Always a pleasure to be with you, and thank you very much for the invitation to chat some golf.
All right. I'm going to let you do more chatting, and I'm going to listen because I know you got a lot of great things to say. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, we're going to talk about Mind Golf. We'll get an update on that and how are things moving along and some of the other things that you've got cooking there. But I wanted to talk about, you know, since we're both Canadian, about the Canadian Open. I mentioned that to you when we set this up. And obviously this year, again, because of the pandemic, they canceled the event, which was supposed to be back in June. Hopefully, you know, hopefully we're going to have it next year, but we'll see what's going to happen with this pandemic that seems to be surging and rising here and there. But I want to talk to you about a little bit about the history of the game. Now, obviously, I know you've played in the Canadian Open, obviously, over the years. And one question that comes to mind right off the bat is there was always a lot of talk and a lot of people considered it, not just in Canada but elsewhere, that the Canadian Open was considered to be the fifth major. First off, do you agree with that in your assessment? And should it have been made a fifth major?
Well, it used to be, you know, when it was considered, this is before the Players' Championship. The Players' Championship came about in, I think, around the early 70s. But prior to that, the Canadian Open, and I don't think there's any fifth major. And if there is going to be a fifth major, I believe it should be the Players' Championship. I think all the, you know, the Open Championships governed by the RNA, U.S. Opens, the USGA, PGA, of course, is the PGA of America, and so forth. And the players themselves, the tour, they're a governing body, and they're the people that are the contestants that are playing in it. So if there's going to be any major, fifth major, it should be the Players' Championship. And but what you're we're talking about was back in the day when they used to take only four players to the World Series of Golf, and that was it at Firestone. If Lee Trevino, when he won the U.S. Open and the British Open, they went to the Canadian Open to get that next guy in line. So that was kind of the de facto fourth if someone won two majors in that year. So that's kind of where it got that position. But since then, you know, the Canadian Open or the RBC Canadian Open as it is today has changed a lot. It's gone through a lot of evolutions, and it was, you know, down the pecking order for as far as the PGA Tour event goes for quite some time. Now RBC has really done a great job with their ambassador team, and they have the Heritage Classic in Hilton Head as well, and they're doing a great job.
Right.
And it's unfortunate they haven't gotten back, because they had some, you know, St. George's the past couple of years is just one of the greatest golf courses on this planet.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where actually it was going to be held this year if it had have gone through. So unfortunately, you know, regrettably, they put it off another year, again, because of the COVID concerns. And it's understandable.
Sure.
So what were some of your – I mean, for many years – let me back up for a second. For many years, the Canadian Open was held, in fact, 30, I believe, at Glen Abbey in Oakville, Ontario.
Yeah.
And that was always a fun and interesting. I used to go every year that I could to watch you guys tee it up, and a lot of great memories there and some interesting holes. What are some of your, in general, of the game? We'll get to that in a minute. What are some of your fond memories of playing at Glen Abbey and the Canadian Open in general? What were some of your fond memories of that event particularly at that venue?
I've got a lot of fond memories, and my very first Canadian Open, I was just finished my freshman year at Brigham Young University, and I qualified, got to play in 1978 at Glen Abbey, and boy, at that time, this golf course was tough. That was, you know, Jack had just finished Glen Abbey, just finished building Memorial, and those were some of the toughest golf courses on the tour at the time. And so that was a fond memory. A couple other ones. One, I think it was 87 or 88 that I had the 54-hole lead, or tied with the lead going into the final round. And, you know, I hadn't won yet. And this is, you know, the Canadian Open is like it's a major championship to us Canadians. And and so the pressure, and I was tied with Curtis Strange, and I'm playing in the final group, and Curtis Strange is the number one player in the world. And quite frankly, I think he knew he was going to win. I knew he was going to win. And he knew that I knew he was going to win. And I'm trying to settle down. I shoot, you know, make three bogeys and no birdies that day. And I'm just trying to, you know, be as comfortable as possible. But another time, I think it was 84, I finished fifth in the tournament. And I'm on the 18th hole. That's right, when Greg Norman wins the tournament, and he's going head-to-head with Jack, and they're coming down 17, and I'm coming down 18, and this is on Sunday, and I make this shot, and I birdie the last hole, and it's on television, and the roar of the crowd backed Jack Nicklaus off his shot on 17, and usually Jack does that to other people, and I was like,
right,
pretty cool. I backed Jack Nicklaus off his shot when my birdie went in. So though I remember that, and I recall Jack, it was his design, and he kind of like played host when he was still playing, and he was like a father to so many young players, and he was so nice and warm to everybody, and it was I've got some fantastic memories playing 26 of those Canadian Opens, and a lot of fond memories that are under the bridge now, Ted.
Yeah, it was. I hear you. You know, it was a great event. One of the things I really loved about Glen Abbey, and you don't see a lot of in other golfing venues, certainly not on the PGA Tour, or at least at that point. And you obviously could describe it much better than I could. Is you had, I believe, was it five holes that were down in the valley? I think it started with hole number 11, and then
11,
I think was 15 or. Yeah, and then what was it, 15
popped
or 16, 16 was the last hole?
16.
That's right.
15 was the last one, yes, the par 3, yeah. And,
how about playing?
The valley holes were very interesting. 11, you teed off from a massive drop to the middle of the fairway. It was beautiful, one of the best holes out there. Then you've got this 16-mile creek that runs through that valley on the bottom that comes into play on a few shots, but great golf course. And then it changed. It's ironic that it was such a tough golf course in the 70s when it came on tour. And then when Glen Abbey kind of left the PGA Tour as the venue, it was a very easy golf course. It's just, I suppose, the way players have evolved and how the game has evolved and the equipment's evolved, it really turned it from one of the most difficult golf courses on the PGA Tour to literally one of the easiest golf courses on the PGA Tour.
I remember years ago, one of the very first times I ever went to Glen Abbey, I made the mistake, and you'll know what I'm talking about, and down in the valley there's a bridge crossing over the creek. I think it's just after hole 12. And if you didn't, depending on which group you were following, if you had a – you know, if you're with the leaders or whatnot, I mean, you're crazy to go down there anyways because you'd never get out to be able to watch them play. But if you didn't get in front, in other words, if you didn't cross that bridge before the leaders came up, you weren't getting across because the crowds were just so tremendous at that point. What were some of the tough holes? What did you find, and I'm talking about Glen Abbey, of course, what were some of the tough holes for you that really presented you the most challenges?
Well, you know, I remember I played a lot. As it turned out, I played a lot with Lee Trevino. Sorry for the cough on that. Mm-hmm. And watching him play, and I had the fortune to play well there for quite a few years. And the tee shot on 11 was very hard to put into the fairway, and if you didn't, you got into trouble. The 12th, the par 3 was difficult. The par 5 was an opportunity on 13 to go for and 2, perhaps, if you were a long hitter, which I wasn't. So you had to rely on that wedge shot. The tee shot on 14 with this angled creek that was going, and the more space you bit off to the right, the more you had to carry. That presented a challenge. And I recall, remember, like on 14, I'd hit a good tee shot off the tee and get it in the fairway, and I'd have a 3-iron into these greens, and they were tough Nicklaus courses, and he always built his courses that suited his game, where if you were able to hit your long irons soft and with a fade, you had an advantage, and I just didn't have that shot. I had to, I hit it low and hard, which was my shot. So I found it to be a very challenging golf course, but there was, it was fun. I remember one time coming off the 13th, Trevino got into it with one of the guys, one of the people in the fans, and boy, oh boy, I saw a side of Trevino. Like, I love Lee. He's loved playing with him. He's a great player. But boy, you, someone says something in the wrong way or in a certain wrong manner, he has no problem getting into the crowd and getting after it. It'd be interesting to see what would happen today with today's game.
I want to share very quickly with you a Lee Trevino story from the Canadian Open. I don't recall which year it was, but I used to follow a lot of different players. But one year I was fortunate enough, I got in and followed Lee. And this, of course, was when his caddy Herman was still on the scene, and before Herman had lost the weight, so he was, you know, as you know, a big man. And it was before they had moved it from June to September, and then they've moved it back. I know, but in June it would get pretty hot up, and even in Glen Abbey up in Canada, it would get pretty humid, right?
Yes, and it would.
So, you know, of course, everybody's sweating, and I remember a couple of instances, two particular that happened that particular day. It was on Sunday, and it was on the 10th hole was the first one, and I was on the left side of the fairway, of course, following the group, and it was hotter than Hades, and Lee was just really sweating up a storm, and he asked Herman for the towel. Well, the whole time the front nine, they were walking around, Herman had been wiping his brow and everything else with his towel, and by the time he handed it over to Lee, it was just sopping wet and full of his sweat, and the look that Trevino gave him could have launched 1,000 ships. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but it wasn't kind, put it that way. And he just sort of threw him back, you know, the towel back. But the other one that really struck home, that and you know what it's like around the 18th green when you've got the fans all around there towards the end of Sunday. And Trevino was, I don't recall who he was playing with, but he came up the 18th fairway, and he hit a, you know, hit his shot onto the green, and it was so hot that nobody thought, there were bets going on throughout the day that Herman wasn't going to make it. There was just, he was going to have a heart attack. He was going to collapse. It was just dog darn hot. Trevino got up onto the 18th green. I kid you not. And he got a, had a little towel with him, and he laid it out on the green, and he got down. And Herman's, of course, fixing the, you know, the divot out in the fairway, and he's walking up, and Trevino drops to his knees and just starts bowing as Herman's walking up towards the green. And by this time, there was about 35 or so thousand fans around there, and they just went crazy. They just laughed, and they were just chuckling because nobody thought Herman was going to make it around the golf course, and even Lee didn't believe it. And it was a similar situation to what you were talking about earlier. Nicklaus was, I think, still a hole back. And he had to, as you say, pretty much back off because the crowd just went nuts. But, you know, Trevino was just such a showman out there. I mean, he was a phenomenal golfer, as you know, but he just loved to entertain the crowds, and he did a good job that day, I must admit. But it was interesting to watch him play, but the interaction between him and his caddy. And I want to ask you, because I know, obviously, did you have a caddy that you that carried your bag for any length of time? And what was the relationship that you had? What was it that you relied on them for? Because a lot of people that obviously don't play on tour would like to know how the caddies and players really interact out there. What is it you rely on them the most for?
Well, it's basically all the caddies, they know how to go through all the procedures of getting the yardages and their job basically is to, I think, to control the horse just like a jockey does, to kick it in the butt when it needs it, to snap it out of certain types of mindsets type of thing. A good caddy does that. And when it when you mesh with a caddy, you know, you seem to get on the same page of picking the right club, the right shot, and getting them to confirm, not just say yes because they have to say yes, but to absolutely believe this is the right shot. And it gives you a boost, and when you're on that, you it's kind of a rhythmic thing, and at the same time, you can fall out of rhythm with your caddy, and things don't go well, and the chemistry doesn't work, and that's the time when you get to you just trade caddies. I've had caddies for years. I've had caddies for short periods of time. I'd go through phases where I'd get a little sloppy, and I'd take over, you know, and say, give me the yardage book. I'm doing the yardage book. Or because you need to shake things up. Or you say, you need to shake things up the other way and say, here's the yardage book. I'm no longer doing it. I just want to think about the shot. You do the numbers. And sometimes you do both to confirm. I've never been one to let my caddy read my putts. I felt that even though if I read the putt improperly, that my conviction to hit the putt would work out best in the overall. And I just felt like, you know, no one's going to read the putt better than me. I always felt like I could read the putt perfectly. It doesn't always hit the line. But when I did get confused, that's only when I'd bring when I bring my caddy, and it was very on few occasions. I'm not one. I don't like what caddies are doing. I said this to Mike Weir a couple years ago at the Canadian Open. I said, look, picking a shot shouldn't be a committee meeting. You know, what are you going to go into? You know, like what happens if you believe this shot is what you're going to do, and your caddy says something that's very different. Now all of a sudden it could bring doubt into your mind. I said, you better go down swinging than don't swing freely at all. And I always like what Jackie Burke Jr. said. And I guess caddies today are getting better. They're evolving like the players. Caddies today are better than caddies in my time, and then caddies in Jackie Burke Jr.'s day. But Jackie Burke Jr., I love this. He said in his Texas accent, he goes, you know what? He says, I wouldn't ask my caddy for the time of day if he was wearing two wristwatches. I love that saying. So it goes to show you that, times change.
Yeah, and I think there's a time, you know, as you sort of alluded to, I think there's a time, for the caddy to step in if they see that their player is maybe not, and again, obviously it's the player's decisions what they're going to do, but I think there is a time for the caddy to sort of step up and say, you know, hey, maybe this might not be what's going to help you at this particular moment. And obviously some players are going to be more receptive to that, but then there's a time too where they need to step back and just let the player go and not, especially if they're doing well. Right. I mean,
right.
So you've got to find that balance, and that's not an easy thing to do because obviously you've got different personalities, of course.
Well,
but that presents right.
It takes a lot of courage on the caddy's part. You've got to. There's a few that are really good out there. Stevie for all you know, when he was working with Tiger, he worked for Ray Floyd.
Right.
He worked for him. He would take charge. Or I wouldn't say he would take charge. No, that's not true. He wouldn't be afraid to step in, like you mentioned. If he saw his player, you know, they're on track together. The caddy knows when the player is off track, and the player knows when the caddy's off track. So it goes both ways. So sometimes, you know, a player gets off track and he goes down a rabbit hole or something like that, and a good caddy will say, "Hey, pro, you know, back off here. Let's have a thought." And there's nothing wrong with that. That you know, the players go, "Hey, look, let's have a conversation. If you see something, let's talk about it, and then get clarity." The decision's made, and then you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think you know from a caddy standpoint, you know they've obviously got to know their player very very well, and that takes time. I mean, if you're just starting with a caddy right now, let's say you know this year, there's a sort of a trial period where you're getting to know one another, you're getting to feel comfortable with one another, and you know certainly some good decisions, hopefully more good than bad, are going to be made, but there's going to be some bad decisions. And you're right. I think there has to be a certain courage that the caddy has to be able to say, hey, you know, Dick, let's rethink this position right here.
Right.
And if they're afraid to do that, then it's not going to work. And you know what? Sometimes they're going to make a suggestion or they're going to say something to you that's not going to hit the right chord. They've got to be prepared that you're going to hit them with both barrels too. So, you know, they've got to have thick skin, right?
I got to tell you this caddy story of mine. There was this caddy out there, and if you've been on tour any amount of time or been a caddy out there, his name was Harry Cadell, Harry C. And Harry C. was one of the most passionate caddies. I brought him out, this was 1982 in Greensboro. And he wanted to take charge. He couldn't help himself to take charge. And I'd get into more fights with him, and I loved the guy, and he loved me, and he loved everyone. Mm-hmm. He was very close with Tom Lehman and a few guys out there. And I'll never forget, this is 10 years later, or, you know, I won my first golf tournament with Harry C. in 92 in Hattiesburg. And I'll never forget coming down the last few holes, and he could read the grain really well, and I couldn't read grain in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. the green was really strong. And I'd say to him, you know, so I'm got the lead on Sunday in the back nine and trying to win this golf tournament for my first time. And Harry's, he's getting nervous. And I said, Harry, look, I need you to stop trying to take control here. I says, all I want you to do is read the green. I want you to tell me which way the green is going, this way or that way. And that's it. Don't say anything else. Don't tell me how far it is. And he couldn't help himself. And he'd say, bro, I want you to put it out there about 3 feet to the left, and I want you to slide. And I go, Harry, stop. I need you to – we got into almost a fist fight coming down 17 and 18, and I'm just telling him to shut up. And then I win the tournament. It was great. It was fascinating. But then one time we're playing in – this was another 10 years later. We're in Fort Smith, Arkansas, playing in a Corn Ferry Tour event. And in the pro-am, and Harry likes to get in there and control all the amateurs. And the amateurs are nervous to begin with. And Harry's doing this and this. And I just, my eyes are rolling, and I'm just letting Harry do his thing. And so on this par three, Merrill, I'll never forget, it's on the eighth hole. And it's a slope, this green slopes left to right really hard. And this guy's getting up on the tee, and Harry is about to pull it back. And Harry goes, whoa, hold on here. And I go, oh, geez, Harry. And he pulls this amateur off, and he says, what I need you to do is, come on over here. I need you to tee up on this right side of the tee, because your natural fade, you're going to pull it, and it's going to take and sweep down there, and it's going to be perfect. Well, sure enough, if this guy doesn't move his tee over, and he hits this shot, and he makes a hole in one. It was the damnedest thing I've ever seen. And Harry is beaming, and I'm going, oh my God, this is out of control. But Harry was a great guy. People loved him on the tour, even though he was a pain in the butt. A lot of the times his heart was in the right place, and he died far too young.
Yeah.
But a lot of great stories on caddies other than the PGA Tour, that's for sure.
What a great story, and thank you for sharing that. You obviously had the pleasure over your career to play with a lot of great players, some from eras gone by, shall we say, and even some a little bit more recent, before you officially retired from the tour. Who were some of the memorable players that you got to play with that you really enjoyed? Who were the ones that you really, you know, just meshed with out in the golf course?
Well, I mean, as far as an experience goes, like, you know, even though, let's say I'm 63 years old right now, and I got on the tour in 1982, that was a time before the old greats before us, you know, my time. That was fascinating. One of the most special moments I've had is playing with Sam Snead in a PGA Tour event. There used to be this PGA Tour event used to partner with a senior event, and I played with Fred Haas from Louisiana, and we got paired with J.C. Snead and Sam Snead. So it was a treat to just to be able to say I played with Sam Snead in a PGA Tour event. So that was number one. I have gotten to know Byron Nelson. One year we did an Oilman's event up in Banff and gotten to know Byron and Peggy personally, and that's been a treat in my life. He sent me some of the kindest cards when I won, and considered. I mean, he's so gracious with people. If you get to know him, you are truly a friend of Byron's, and that is one of the highlights of my life. But you know, played with Jack Nicklaus on Sunday in a major championship, 1984, at Shoal Creek, and I got to play with Arnold Palmer in the San Diego Open back in 83. It was January 83 or February. I was still wearing the headphones and Disco Dick. It was quite funny, Ted. So I'm on the tee, and I get paired with Arnold Palmer, and I'm nervous as hell. I mean, I'm playing with the king, right? And I'm standing on the tee, and I've got these headphones on. I'm listening to Led Zeppelin or something like that. I don't even know what it was, but it was hard rock. And so Arnie comes up and I meet him, and he goes, "What you got going on here?" I said, "Oh, I just, you know, listen to music." So he says, "Do you mind if I try it?" I said, "Sure." So I take these headphones off. Arnie puts them on, and I mean, Led Zeppelin is cranking it out. I don't think it was Arnie's tunes, but he took it off, shook his head, gave it back to me. But he was a treat to play with as well. But guys like, you know, it was great to play with Trevino, and I played with Gary Player and got to know Gary a little bit. But just the guys in my era, you know, Greg Norman as well. It's just everyone in that category of people. It was just Tom Watson, Nick Price, you know, all the guys. It was they're like family. You spend so much time out there. Mm-hmm. There are wives and children become close with them, and it's like a traveling circus.
Who were some of the tough competitors that you went up against? I mean, obviously you guys were all good in your own way and different styles, if you will. But who were some of the really tough players out there on tour that you got a chance to see and said, wow, these guys are really tight. These guys are good.
Yeah.
Who were some of them?
Trevino was one of those guys when he got playing good. Hale Irwin, probably the toughest guy. I remember I had an experience with Hale that was very positive. It was at the PGA when Azinger won. What was that, 92? At Inverness. And I was playing well. And Hale was playing well. And it was a major championship. Playing with Hale, we kind of both started playing well together. And I noticed he started to appear to me a little different, rather than just totally ignoring, which he does to most golfers. And, you know, that's a mental strength of his. But there was a rhythm thing. I was playing well. He was playing well. And he was giving me the nod. Same with Ray Floyd. I played with Ray Floyd at the U.S. Open up in Rochester as well. And when you play well with these guys, a thing happens. Well, it did in my mind, that they start to accept you and say and respect when you play well. And that's probably some of the coolest things that I've ever experienced, is to be able to kind of stay pace with these guys. And you know, even when I won Milwaukee, and, you know, Greg Norman was in the field, you know, Payne Stewart. Those are the things that you really look forward to competing against. And if you can beat the best who are in the game, then, you know, it makes it that much sweeter.
Yeah, there were some great, you know, players. You've mentioned a number of them, and, you know, they were fun to watch. I can imagine for some, you know, Trevino was probably difficult to play alongside because he was a talker, of course, and liked to kibitz, if you will, out in the golf course. And I know Nicholas, I think, was sort of half kidding, but I know I've heard him say a number of times over the years that he was a challenge, to say the least. I'm trying to put it polite in case he's listening. Were there players, and again, you don't have to get into specifics, but were there players that you found it more difficult to play up against? Not necessarily that they were better or worse or difficult, but maybe their style of play, maybe their rhythm is a better way to put it, just didn't gel with yours. And I'm sure that happens a lot out on tour, where you're maybe a quicker player, they're a little slower, and it throws you off your route. Was there anything like that? Again, you don't have to name names, but were there times like that for you? And if so, how did you overcome it?
Oh, yeah. You have to learn to play with your best friend and your worst enemy. I remember one time at Colonial, I'm playing with a fellow, you know, he's just notorious of not being a nice person. Let's put it that way. You know, as nice as I can put it. And so you try and just go play your own game. And I remember we're on the, whatever it was, the par three over the water, the hole where Annika birdied at Colonial, mm-hmm. It's in Fort Worth, Texas. And it starts to open up and pour. So, and this guy just, he liked to get his nose into other people's business all the time. And I can tolerate guys like that. Not a problem whatsoever. So, it's pouring, and I lag my putt down there, and it goes down there about 2 inches away. And I grab my umbrella from my caddy, leaving him in the rain. I put the umbrella over me, and I walk up and tap my ball into the hole. And he bolts out, "You cannot do that." And I go, "You cannot do what?" He says, "You cannot have that umbrella over your head while you strike a putt." I go, "Yes, I can." He says, "Need to call an official." I go, "Let's call the official."
So Glenn Tate, he comes driving up in his cart, and this guy is such a horse's rear end that he doesn't want to do
right.
it discreetly. He wants to make a noise of it. So I walk over to Glenn. He comes up, and he goes, what's the situation? So I tell him, I said, Glenn, I'm holding the umbrella over my head while it's pouring rain, and I tapped in. And I'm telling the situation, and from 50 yards, this guy goes, Glenn, will that be one shot, or will that be two? And there's no penalty. And he says, no. And he
right.
says, well, that's an artificial, like, you know, thing protected. And I said, so's your rain jacket. He says, you
right.
know, so when I put it in perspective, there's no penalty. And then we're going down the next
right.
one comes over. And I'm just going, you know, I know what this guy's all about. And he says, well, hey, listen, no hard feelings. And I just said, well, I think it's best you just walk on the other side of the fairway. And you just leave it like that. And just, and,
right.
but you've got to have, if your emotions aren't in control, those things, you can't let them get in you, because there's enough horses' rear ends out there in this world, and there's plenty
oh.
of them on the PGA Tour, where you've got to take care of your own business. And if you're a bit concerned like that, you're probably not going to make it very long.
Right. And like you said, it's in every aspect of life. Obviously,
sure.
you know, we all work on our swing. We work on our game. But we also admire another player's approach to the game. Whose swing on tour, both when you were out on tour and today, do you admire? Do you say, you know, wow, they got a great swing, or I really like how they approach the ball? You know, Freddie Couples comes to mind. A lot of people were very envious of Freddie's swing. Another one was Ernie Els, very smooth, very fluid. Was there anybody out on tour at the time when you were playing whose swing you really admired, or even their game that you really admired?
Yeah, yeah. Nick Price. I Nick Price, when he came out, we came out the same, you know, year in the qualifying school, my second go around in 1983. I remember playing a practice round with him, and had just watched him play well and contend in the Open Championship. So he came over, and Nick wasn't a world beater at the start. It took him 5 or 6 years to kind of catch his way. But in his prime, Nick Price's swing, to me, it was on plane, it was structured, it was tight, and it was stable. I love Nick Price's swing and how he could compress
yep.
that golf ball down the line. It was just it was beautiful. So that's a physical swing that I loved. I played with Ernie in 92 in Hong Kong. Ernie had a great golf swing as well, structured, powerful, but not as tight as Nick's pro. Nick's was tight.
Right.
To me, it was fantastic. Today, I was looking at Adam Scott's swing. I think Golf TV put it out on Twitter to music. And boy, oh boy, is that a gorgeous golf swing. And quite frankly, with that, I think he may have, you know, technically the best golf swing there is. And unfortunately, I think with that golf swing, you know, from a mental perspective, Adam has, I wish he had a desire that was just as strong as the swing, because I think that
yeah.
thing, you know, given into a real hard, determined champion's mind, would have produced a lot more major championships.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I was thinking about a number of players, but one particular, and I want to get your thoughts on this. You know, we see so many players that have incredible swings, incredible ball strikers. Luke Donald comes to mind, and the reason why I bring him up is there was a time out on tour when he first came out and he started working with Ledbetter, and his swing was just incredible. Struck the ball well. They were even talked. They said that they thought at that particular time and moment in his career that he was becoming one of the best ball strikers on tour. But yet his repertoire his resume of tournaments, wins, in other words, is pretty light. Why is it, and the reason I'm asking you this, Dick, is because from an amateur standpoint, there's a lot of amateurs listening tonight that go crazy on trying to perfect their golf swing, and yet it
right.
doesn't yield results. Why is a
right.
player like a Luke Donald, not him personally, but just in general, that has such a phenomenal swing, can belt the ball a mile, can get it just wherever he wants to go, but can't seem to put the numbers together to get a win?
Well, Luke Donald was the number one money winner on the European Tour and the PGA Tour in the same year. That's an accomplishment
yep.
no one has ever achieved. And that was, and I think when mm-hmm. you play the European Tour and the PGA Tour, boy, you're burning the candle at both ends. And Luke's mm-hmm. not a big dude. I mean, I think if you want to have stamina, you got to be built literally like a bull in order to have stamina of a bull. And I think mm-hmm. Luke is, he's probably a little smaller than I am. And I think there's, you know, I think he structurally has a great swing. I think it could be a little loose. It could be a little more tighter from mm-hmm. my perspective. Because I think that's where you get the sustained ball striking. And when your ball striking is still real good, that's where you want to get to. But I think you're absolutely right. I think when people do go to, I don't care what, there's a lot of guys, if you're in search of constantly improving your golf swing, if you think that improving your golf swing and perfecting your golf swing will make you a better player, that's a problem. And sure, you know, having a fundamental golf swing is important, but golf performance in golf tournaments is very different than having a good golf swing. And that's what, you mm-hmm. know, MindTrack is all about as well. And it's important. Mm-hmm. So the people that are great champions have great, powerful minds. And I think it's important that we look at that in that direction. Is when specifically when it relates to performance, it's more about how you perform on the golf course. And there's a couple of components
right.
on that are more important. It shouldn't be about golf swing.
Right. And this is going to be a great lead-in to talk about MindTrack now. I want to shift gears one more time as we sort of ease into the latter part of our discussion tonight. There was obviously moments, as any good player has out there, you're striking the ball well, everything's going well, but mentally things aren't just coming together. There came a point in time you talked about here, and you mentioned it the last time, where sort of the light went on, and you said it was in the final round of the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, where you sort of had that breakthrough moment. What was the realization that you discovered at that point? What was going on before? Let's back up. What was going on
before
then?
That,
yeah. And what was it? What was about that particular moment that a light went on and said, "Aha! Here's what the problem is. Now I get it."
Yeah, in 1999, I was coming back to the PGA Tour after taking a bit of time off, and I really wanted to make some changes. Number one, in my putting, I wanted to be a better putter, and obviously a better player. And at the end of 1999, I was trying to access the present moment. I read enough books, worked with enough sports psychologists, that I knew that in order to play your best, and I played my best, and everyone plays their best when they're in the present moment. And I found out that every time I got into contention, I couldn't get in the present moment. I would get too anxious. And I think every golfer can understand that. You don't need to be a tour player to understand that. So I said, I have to change something because I'm going backwards in these situations. And I started to look at where my attentional focus was. And it was always on the score or always on the result. So knowing mm-hmm. that old adage that you've got to stop being result oriented, I started to look at, well, where do I have to put my attention? And so at that moment, I decided that we had to put your attention, break the habitual pattern of thought from being result oriented and shifting your attentional thought onto your two key performance markers of every single shot. And then it leads to the next question. Well, what are those? Well, there's two key performance markers, like in the business world, we do key performance indicators, and it's a metrics in which what directly hits the bottom line, the performance. So golf is no different. Every golf shot's no different. And those two things are being able to assess the shot. So if you're putting, that's mm-hmm. read the green, and then execute the shot that you see. And then putting your attention on those. So I created this system in longhand. And after every round, after every shot, my goal going into every shot was, okay, my goal right here, you do a hard reset for every single shot. And your goal is to make an excellent assessment and an excellent execution. And if you do that to your level of ability, you'll perform well. And you want to put your attention on those two things. And then you grade those two key performance markers. So let's say you're standing on the 17th hole at Sawgrass in the Players' Championship on Sunday and everything's coming unglued, or you're in a pressure situation. Because you've conditioned yourself to think this way, it's part of your pre-shot routine. So your first job is
right.
to assess, get the yardage. What's the yardage? Okay, it's 156. Where's the pin? Oh, it's tucked over to the right, over the bunker, right beside the water. So part of your assessment
right.
is to pick the right club. What is the wind coming in this way or coming in that way? What kind of shot are you going to hit? And where are you going to? Are you going to go at the pin? You're going to hook it in there around the water, or are you going to fade it in there from the middle of the green? All these factors make up your assessment. So you come to that conclusion, you make a decision. And then your job is to execute it. And then after you're finished that shot, regardless of where it goes, you give yourself a judgment of excellent, satisfactory, or unsatisfactory to each of those two key performance markers. So in our app at MindTrack, you collect that data. So I was starting to get really good at this, and I started to literally, Ted, detach emotionally from the results. So I'm standing over a 5-foot putt, and my attention is not to make the putt. It's to, have I got this assessed properly? Yes, I really do. And then this is the execution.
Right.
And when I execute that putt and it goes in the hole, it gives me a feeling that I'm going, wow, I really got control now. Because prior to that, I'd go, oh, knock it in. I've got to make this putt. And I would literally make a poor execution and vomit on myself over this putt. That's when I get really mad.
Right.
Because that's just craziness. So my shift
right.
in focus to all these things, it got to a point where I got very good at it, and I became very motivated to score well on my key performance markers. That's what I changed my onto. And when I did that, I literally didn't know where I was on score, and it didn't matter. I kept it up, and it got me to the point where I shot on Sunday. I went out there. When I shot 30 on the front nine on Sunday at the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach in 2000, I walked off onto the 10th tee walking down the fairway, and my caddy says, you know what you shot? And I went, no, and I don't care. And he told me that you shot 30. I went, wow, that's pretty damn good for U.S. Open. I still didn't care. That was when the aha moment. I still didn't care when he told me. I stayed on top of my key performance markers, and I went, wow, this is something special.
And obviously, you know, as you mentioned, you put this together in an app to allow the rest of us to be able to do the same thing. So when somebody's utilizing this app, when they're using the app, kind of gently walk us through the process. What are they doing with the app? How does it generally work? And then once they've gone through their round, obviously I'm assuming there's a system that they can go back and look at and assess and say, okay, this is where I did this. This is where I did that. There's information that's going to give them some good feedback, right? So go ahead.
Yeah. After every round, you get three reports sent to you and your golf coach. So part of the app is, and it's called MindTrack Golf. You can, anyone, we're still in our beta program, but you can go to the Apple Store and download it for free. And MindTrack is MindTrak, MindTrack, no C in there. So what you do is you load up any golf course you're going to play, and you go through the process of putting your profile in there, and you're going to play your golf course today, and you do all that setup. And you before every round, you know, it defaults to the first hole, but if you're playing a shotgun, you can change, you ting off on the 14th or do all that stuff. You've got to, then you want to identify whether it's a casual round, a serious round, or a tournament round, because those types of round really are a significant factor in the perception of every player. I think you know exactly what I'm talking about, and your listeners are who are, you know, you play in your club championship, and all hell breaks loose, and so and the data you capture in those rounds are very different. So that tells you right there, it's very psychological. So what you do, you're on the first hole, and it defaults, if it's a par four, it defaults to your driver. So your goal obviously is to make an excellent assessment, that, you know, and an excellent execution. So after the moment you hit your shot, I pull it out of my back pocket and I click three buttons, and it takes 3 seconds, and I enter the data of the club I used on whether grading the assessment and grading the execution. It goes back in my pocket. Then I hit my second shot, and you do this all the way through the hole. And let's say I hit my tee shot out of bounds on the first hole, Ted. So I make an unsatisfactory execution. My provisional, I hit it down the middle, hit it on the green, two putt, pretty standard thereafter, and make a six. So at the end of the hole summary, you put in your shot lost events and shot gained events. So there's a page on there where there's a plus button and a minus button. So on the tee shot where it says it profiles my unsatisfactory execution, there's a unhappy face. That's the emoji that says my unsatisfactory execution. Well, I'm going to hit that minus spot twice, and it's going to pop up as two lost shot events attached to the execution of that tee shot. And then I move on to the next hole. And then on the next hole, I am going to do the same thing. On every hole, you punch in each shot's valuation of your key performance marker, your assessment, your execution. And then on the hole summary, you start to attach shots gained. Like, say, on the second hole, I drop a 30-foot putt for birdie. And then I'm going to go on so I obviously made an excellent execution with that putt and an excellent assessment. And then I'm going to attach a shot gained event to that second shot, the birdie putt, or whatever the putt was. And then you're going to go through your whole round, and you know, as a golf pro, that the best way to improve a golfer's ability and performance on the golf course is to stop them hemorrhaging lost shot events through the round. You can go through, you're hemorrhaging 8-9 shots a round. And if you just shore up that battle and improve it and reduce that number down, you're going to improve. So that's what and so when you finish the round, three reports pop out. And if your coach is, if you've invited your coach to be on your, on the app, and he or she's on the app as well, every single round of golf that you finish, these three reports are going to automatically go to all the people that you put on your share list. It can be your swing coach, your mental coach, your fitness coach, your nutrition coach, and your recovery coach, if you've got one. And they're going to get so these reports, and I'm going to go through them. The first report is called the scorecard report, and it's going to give you an outline round on the front nine and back nine of every shot lost event and shot gained event you had. And then the second report is called the key performance marker trend graph. So your key performance markers, after three rounds, you're going to create your own baseline standard. And then each round after that is going to be a percentage up or percentage down based on your baseline standard. Because this data that's compared to PGA Tour players in ShotLink, that's not good data that you need to be or most people need to be compared to. They need to be compared against their own data. And then the third report, the round summary, it identifies where your shot lost events and your shot gained events are as they relate to all your full shots, like your tee shot, your three wood, long iron, mid iron, short iron, and your short game, all the short game categories, which is short game is bunker, pitch, chip, putts off the green is a category. And so that way your coach can then take a look at your performance on the golf course and then better subscribe a program that's going to go towards the performance right at the bottom line. So an example like this lesson that we're going to have tomorrow, because we want to develop club head speed, because that's the rage to hit it far now. We say, you know what? Right. I see you, Ted, you're around the past few weeks. You're really losing a lot of shots around the green because you're not assessing the green properly. We got to work on that.
Right.
So I hope that makes a little sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. And as a coach, you want to be able to eliminate a lot of the guesswork. So this is really what this is doing for a coach. And obviously, if somebody's working with a coach or a teacher professional, you definitely want to have them on your list and share that information, because that's invaluable data for us to have to be able to look at our players and say, okay, here's what they're doing. Here's where the areas that they're showing weakness and so forth. And, you know, because otherwise they're just coming to the next session and, you know, you're going through that process verbally and trying to, you know, get an assessment. So this way it helps me as a coach to be able to prepare ahead of time if they've played last weekend and they're not coming to see me until next week, getting that information in real time, I'm able to look at that and assess what needs to be focused on. So when they come to the next session, I can say, okay, here's what we need to get down to business on. I think it's fantastic, and I like the simplicity of how it works. Go ahead, sorry.
When we commercially launch, what we anticipate we're going to be able – this is going to be a revenue generator for a lot of coaches. First of all, they're going to be able to expand. Like, we don't want them to stop their principles of teaching, their version of the golf swing.
Sure.
But they need to also adapt into kind of this importance of mental fitness to their students. Golf is a perfect metaphor for life. We all know that. But it also allows the coach to see their key performance on the golf course where their shots are being lost. But more importantly, to expand into this mental fitness aspect of performance and trying to get their students, because the real kind of inflection point where you get into the zone is conditioning a person's swing. Say you've gone through some swing changes, is getting them to a point where they're letting it go. That whole kind of you have to give up control in order to gain control, that the great George Knutson always said. So you're out there executing shots on the golf course, not playing golf swing. And then once you're able to let go of your execution, just let it go and not try and be bound up by mechanics. And when you get to that mindset where you learn to detach emotionally, this is where the zone is. And Ted, this is where that inflection point of performance really makes a difference, and that's when people go low. And that's what happened to me on that Sunday when I didn't know I shot 30. My caddy said, "You know, do you know what you shot?" And I went, "No." And that's kind of the mental aspect that we want to. You know, you can't get into that state of mind all the time, but you want to be able to access it a lot more often than. And you got to stop this mind chatter. You know, one of the biggest problems in golf is, you know, when golfers are left to their own device, you know, without any guidance, you know, they absolutely routinely cultivate a harmful interpersonal perspective. Yep. They talk bad to themselves. Golfers talk, the language they use to themselves in their own interpersonal dialogue, you would never speak to anyone like that, or else you might get shot. So,
well, and the that, other thing too, that, yeah, the other
go
thing,
ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. No, finish your thought.
So it's important because, you know, people's, you know, they have poor to outrageous self-dialogue. You got to stop that. And you've got to get to a point where your ego is out of the game, because your ego is just constantly, you know, looking for, you know, results, expectations. They're concerned with what other people think. And you've just got to stop that in order to access the present moment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I always equate with some players that, you know, we work with and that to taking a trip and going to the airport. They're bringing their baggage with them. And I see a lot of guys coming to the first, you know, to the first tee or to the practice tee, whatever the case is for a lesson. And they're literally pulling every baggage. So every bad round they've had for the last, you know, few months or even last, you know, practice session that didn't go the way they wanted to go, they're thinking about that all the time and they're never moving past it. So you're exactly right. I mean, the self-talk, the self-dialogue is so damaging in golf, and it's probably one of the worst games where people do that. Most other games, it's so, you know, it's a quick reaction, that sort of thing, and you don't have time to think. But golf, you get these guys standing over the golf ball for 3 minutes, right?
Right, and it's so important, and we're talking to the PGA of America to bring this type of aspect to the long-term player development, because this is really where the mental health aspect of it is. And today, all we got to do is, you know, look at what's going on with Simone Biles, Matthew mm-hmm. Wolf,
yep.
Naomi Osaka. Cameron Champ has just made mm-hmm. some remarkable changes of what he's doing. Now, and take a look at Patrick Cantlay. And now I'm giving examples of people that are struggling with their thoughts and anxieties
yep.
and those who have mastered them. Patrick Cantlay, what he's been doing in the past couple of weeks, going up against, you know, DeChambeau and John Rahm the last 2 weeks,
right.
in the manner in which he's doing it with his game is just mm-hmm. exceptional. So he is just as good as Tiger Woods in his prime and Jack Nicklaus. Now, what he's doing and not getting too excited, his emotional maturity. So we, as instructors and coaches, this is what we must instill into these kids and get them to mm-hmm. a point where their personal identity is not wrapped up in their game. Because if these golfers think they're better people when they play well, and have less value when they play poorly, they are mistaken. And,
right.
and we as the coaches
yep.
have to get on top of these younger people's mind when they're in their formative years, and so they can mature
yep.
into not only good golfers, but better people in life.
I couldn't agree more. And it's amazing how many young players, you know, a year or two out on tour when things aren't going the way that they, you know, would expect or hope that they would go.
Right.
How many of them just want to walk away from the game? And it's because, again, it's what's going on, the dialogue that's going on in their head. It's not that their game isn't solid. It's not that they can't hit the ball. They would have never made it there to begin with if they didn't have a good, solid game. But mentally, they just are not able to hold it together. And that's the difference between somebody like a Tiger
right.
Woods and some of the other players out there that have just as good a ball-striking ability as he did, but they just didn't
right.
have the same mental strength, or Jack Nicklaus. And you're right. That's what has to be worked on. They have to be able to have that self-talk. But I hate to say this, but we gotta wrap up. And I've been enjoying the conversation. And as always, it's interesting, and I appreciate your insight into life on tour and some of the stories that you shared earlier. And I'm definitely going to have you back if you'll come back, and we can talk some more. But Richard, as always, thank you very, very much for spending some time with me. And for the folks that want to learn more about Mindtrack Golf, go to mindtrackgolf.com. All of the information that Dick was talking about tonight is on their website, and you can actually click on the link there to the Apple Store, and you can download the app for free presently, and you know, learn a little bit more about Mindtrack Golf. But Richard, thank you very, very much. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some insight with my audience.
Well, Ted, it's always a pleasure. We, you know, an hour goes by so quickly, and I'd be happy to be on your show anytime you want.
Well, I'm glad to have you back, and I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to get you back on here.
Okay.
We got lots of things. I wanted to get to some Mo Norman stories, but we'll have to get that another time. I'm sure you have a few. I've got a couple myself, but we'll have to
yeah.
save that for another time. But again, Richard, thank you very much for spending tonight on Golf Talk Live. It's a pleasure as always, and much continued success. Keep us updated on Mindtrack. Let us know how everything's going, and I'll have you back on again real soon.
Thank you, Ted.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night.
All right. That was my very special guest, Richard Zokel, founder and developer of Mindtrack Golf. Again, you can go to mindtrackgolf.com, get all of the information there, and you can download the app for free at the Apple Store. There's the link right there on the website, and you can go there and check it out for yourself. I strongly recommend that you do that. Also want to thank again John Hughes and Pete Buchanan for joining me a little bit earlier on this evening on Coach's Corner. Thanks, guys, for always bringing your best, and I look forward to seeing you guys next time. Have a great weekend, everybody, and again, our hearts and thoughts and prayers go out to all of those families that were affected by September 11th, of course. The memorial, again, the 20-year memorial will be this Saturday, and there'll be, I'm sure, lots of coverage on that, but again, our hearts and thoughts and prayers go out to all of those families that were directly impacted, and obviously all of the folks here in the U.S. that have forever been had their lives changed as a result of those events. So, again, we're keeping you in our thoughts and prayers. God bless everybody. I'll see you next week right here on Golf Talk Live.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this week's broadcast of Golf Talk Live. We'd like to thank this week's Coach's Corner panel, and a special thank you to tonight's guest. Remember to join Ted every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Central on Golf Talk Live.
And be sure to follow Ted on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you're interested in being a guest on Golf Talk Live, send Ted an email at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. This has been a production of the iGolf Sports Network.